Good evening. It's 6 o'clock. You're listening to Upstage on CKUT 90.3 FM and at CKUT.ca, the show about theater on the radio. From drama to musicals to burlesque to comedy and everything in between, professional student and community productions in and around Montreal, the island also known as Jojage in the Ganyagaha language and Muniang in Anishinaabe Mohan, where we spell theater with an R-E at the end. I'm your host, Sarah Day, recording from home on Thursday, January 4th, 2024. A very happy new year. I hope you had a restful and fun holiday break. For tonight's show, I will be revisiting some favorite conversations from the second half of 2023. My guests tonight include Yannick Truesdale, star of the hit TV show Gilmore Girls, who still lives part-time here in Montreal, how the Screen Actors Guild strike gave him a chance to appear on stage at Théâtre Jean Duceppe.
Something more natural with my personality and energy that I had to adapt for camera work, which I've learned, obviously, because I've been doing it for 35 years. But my personality and my energy is bigger than for camera. So on stage, I just feel kind of freer.
Another Canadian TV star favorite, Jake Epstein, who rose to fame as a teen on Degrassi, playing a troubled young man. He performed a solo musical show about his adventures in show business before, during, and after Degrassi, from dizzying heights to the lowest of lows.
This show I wrote at a time in my life when I was really stuck and really confused about how to keep going. And so I wrote this show 4 years ago, and the fact that it's become this thing that I've gotten to perform around Canada and that it's meant something to people has just been way beyond my greatest dreams and, you know, expectations.
And finally, we'll meet two theater makers and friends in Toronto who forayed into audio drama this year with their podcast Feedback. There's director Jill Harper.
I have an idea for something, and I think we could record it. Like, I think we could do it even though we can't do live theater.
And writer Kevin Shea.
This woman doesn't know anyone like Akbar, but she gets to talking with him because she's got this issue with her phone bill. And over the course of trying to resolve this issue, they end up developing this intimacy, and they end up getting to know each other.
Their show Feedback is available to stream wherever you get your podcasts. You can follow us for updates, images of guests, and more on Instagram at UpstageCKUT. You can also say hi. For our first interview tonight, Yannick Truesdale is the first of our two TV star Chez Nous interviews. The Montrealer first rose to prominence outside of Quebec when he appeared as the finicky concierge Michel in the popular network TV show Gilmore Girls, about a mother and daughter in Stars Hollow, Connecticut, and of course, all of their friends and family members. Yannick continues to act in both Montreal and in LA, with a recent appearance on the TV show Les Mecs, of which there's been three seasons. In 2022, he lost his mother to Parkinson's after a long illness. He's since gone on to do fundraising and awareness around that illness. Yannick also owns Spin Energy, a fitness studio on Park Avenue, not too far from CKUT. The Screen Actors Guild strike in 2023 barred many performers like Yannick from working, but some were able to continue gigs from outside the purview of SAG, and that led Yannick to something he had not done in quite a while, perform on a Montreal stage. He played a supporting role in Docteur by Robert Icke, which centers around a female doctor who's caught up in a viral moment when she bars a priest from administering last rites to a very sick teenager. The Jean Duceppe show tackled medical ethics and many other questions during its run last October and November. I spoke with Yannick Truesdale earlier this fall. Welcome to Upstage, Yannick. Thank you for being here.
Hi.
How does it feel to be on stage again?
I'm having the time of my life, for real. I'm from the theater. Originally, I did a theater school, and I hadn't done it in 27 years, but I did it a lot when I came out and graduated. And the feel, everyone asked me, oh, it must have been a lot of work, and you must have been so stressed, you know, going back to something that you haven't done in so long. But it kind of felt like going back home for me. It just, there's something more natural with my personality and energy that I had to adapt for camera work, which I've learned, obviously, because I've been doing it for 35 years. But But my personality and my energy is bigger than for camera. So on stage, I just feel kind of freer.
Yeah, because you're, for people who aren't so super familiar, I think the common line is that you have to be more natural when you're in front of the camera. You're playing to the camera. And when you're on stage, it's just bigger, bigger energy.
It's not so much natural. I wouldn't use, because you still have to be natural on stage. If you're not believable, an actor has to be believable, whatever the medium. But more, you can't project. You can't have too many expressions. It's just too much for the camera. So you just have to learn to be more subtle with your truth. That's it. That's the difference. It's subtleties. And when you have 1,000 people, obviously the person in the back has to feel and get what you're experiencing. So you're still true, but in a bigger way, if that makes sense.
When you were meeting the cast and crew of Docteur and getting ready to put the show on, did you get a sense from people that were like, oh, this is the TV guy. We got to give him some space.
No,
we got to get some time. We got to let him get acclimated.
No, actually, no. Quite the opposite, because first of all, they all knew that I had done theater before. And also I arrived quite ready, because that's the way you have to be on TV. You show up and you already have made choices. And so I kind of did it the same that way, which was a bit faster than the theatrical process. So very quickly, I had a sort of a performance together, if that makes sense.
You talked about the theater being a natural place for you, like being at home. Is there anything in terms of the technicalities of stage versus set performance that you kind of had to get back into, you know, because you've got long rehearsals and then you're going on stage?
Yes. Yeah, it's very, very long. I complained a lot about it. Because in New York, I think they rehearse for like 5 or 6 weeks and they're done. And here it's like 3 months and a half, which I thought it felt long to me.
Wow.
But that's how they do it here. But other than that, when you're on stage, I would say projection and physicality, because you're in an open space and you're trying to convey in its specific play that you're in a hospital. So you have to use more of your imagination when you're on camera. If you're shooting in a hospital, you're in a hospital. So you don't have to imagine that you're in a hospital. So it requires more imagination for stage work, I would say.
And looking at a photo of the stage, it seems like it's quite spare. I don't know if you'd agree with that assessment. What is it like? How would you describe the set, trying to convey a hospital room? And it's a bit of a tense storyline as well. How do you feel on stage?
Well, Giuseppe, I think, has the biggest stage in the city. So it is quite a stage to have it. But I love what Marie-Ève, the director, did with the set designer, is that they used kind of like hospital curtains, but the sheer through that you could see through to create a hospital atmosphere, but also by moving them, you can change and be in her house and in different areas, which really works beautifully. People keep mentioning how beautiful it is and how smooth and great those transitions are. So yeah, I feel good about it. At first, it felt very big in rehearsal, the space where we were, but now it kind of feels like home. No.
Yeah, I guess after a certain amount of time, you get cozy. But It just looks very clean to me, which is so opposite from what you might expect at a hospital. So this has got so many interesting layers in it, because there's questions of morality, but also care. We meet a female doctor who's our main protagonist. Can you tell me about some of the ordeal that she's facing in Doctor?
Well, it's a play about it's very current. It was written 3 years ago by Robert Hike. It's a British play, and it's about identity, it's about the cancel culture, it's about morals, it's about religion, but it's about a doctor who refuses the last rite to let a priest enter a room of a teenager who's dying, who self-administered an abortion. And the doctor was sent by the parents to give her the last rite because they're Catholic and they're religious. And the doctor doesn't have an order from the parents and have not heard from the parents. And in that case, when it's a child, it is the doctor's decision. And because she doesn't have it in her books and didn't receive a request, she refuses access to the girl, and the girl dies alone. That's the premise of the show, and this is going to spiral into a crisis because the media and the public is going to run with her decision. And it's going to be the repercussion of that decision throughout the play. And it is beautifully illustrated how in our culture, sometimes something very small becomes a huge deal and people lose their career, their livelihoods, their life. And it's kind of crazy. And the show is the writer is illustrated beautifully.
I'm speaking with a very talented Yannick Trousdale, who is in Docteur at Théâtre Jean Duceppe right now, on for another week or so. You mentioned how relevant this story is and just how many facets it touches on. Was there any particular theme or current event that kept coming up for you that you felt like hewed very close to this? Like, what do you think an audience member is thinking of when they sit down and see the show?
Well, the beauty of this show is that most people start watching the show and having an opinion and a position. And as you learn about the characters and details, people shift. And depending where you are in the play, your position changes. And so everyone is kind of right and everyone is kind of wrong. And it's beautifully, beautifully written in that way, so that you're constantly challenged in your beliefs.
There's nothing black and white about it in that sense.
No. Which like in life, there's nothing black and white in life. Certain things, but few.
You're part of a very formidable cast, including Alistair Val and Harry Stanjofsky, who's very popular in the English theater scene here as well. Tell me about the vibes in the cast.
It's a great vibe. I have to say, theater has a lot to do with the cast, and because it becomes a family, you work for such a long stretch and you're together for a long time, and you have to have each other's back when you're live on stage. And I really feel that with everyone. It's a great group of people. Everyone is talented, but everyone is kind, which is, at my age, you really want that. I just want to be surrounded by kind people and great people. And it's the case here. So I really lucked out.
I guess the workplace connections or having a good vibe is something that you don't always find, but what is it about this time you think that makes everyone gel so well?
That's kind of like a mystery. I don't have an answer. What makes a group jive together or not? It's chemistry. It's personalities. It just so happened that this group of personalities together is a good match. I mean, that's a hard one to assess.
Do you think the director has a hand in that, Marie-Ève Milo?
I mean, Marie-Ève is great and very kind and works always joyful and always in a good mood. So obviously that creates a vibe, but I've heard stories where the director is great, but the people just don't get along together. I mean, there's nothing the director can do about that.
I was thinking about all your experience in television work, and we often see medical dramas playing out on TV, in 30-minute, 42-minute episodes every single week, like Grey's Anatomy or ER. Do you get a sense from the audience that people are looking? I think we love these shows because they're thrillers, right? We're always on the edge of our seat.
This plays a psychological thriller for sure.
So you think that kind of edge of your seat excitement is conveyed, but on the stage?
Oh, for sure. Oh, for sure. 100%. People keep talking about it. Yes.
So do you think there's more theater work in your future?
Oh, 100%. But the problem with it is my schedule usually don't allow it. The magic of the timing of this offer is that it came in while we were on strike. in LA, so I couldn't work anyway. So I had the time to do it. But time is really the issue here. But I will do more theater. I just don't know when.
What did you, how was your reaction when you heard about the news coming through late last night?
Oh, I was so happy ending. for everyone. It's been painful for a lot of people. So I was thrilled.
And so will you be getting back to work as soon as the curtain falls on Docteur?
No, I'm going to LA. I have a month and a half off, and then I start a new show in New York and Paris.
Oh, that's fabulous. You must be excited.
Yes, very.
And you're also super busy with business. Like, you have the spin class, a gym as well. And I was just wondering for you, how do you keep everything together with when you get, obviously, it's not been so busy the last couple of months in terms of film and TV work. But as someone who's a business person and an actor and an ambassador. Yeah.
It's a lot. I spin energy. You're referring to my spin studio. It's a lot, but I like to be busy. But sometimes at my age, I'm like, do I need to work that much? that's a thought I have sometimes. But I like to be busy. I like the spin studio. I like my career. It gives me some sort of balance to do something that is different, but yet still creative and with people. So I like it.
I want to end on Docteur, and I want to ask you, for the audience that's going to come see you for these last few showings, what is something that you're very proud of about your character, what you developed in your character, or something that we can look for?
Well, he's the antagonist of the show. So I went to see the production in New York, the original production, the British production of Docteur, and I thought everything about it was brilliant, and I loved it. But the person playing my character was a woman, and I was very puzzled by her choices with the character.
Okay,
and so didn't quite work for me. I truly didn't understand what was happening.
But it was fun for you then to get to sink your teeth into reimagining the character.
Yeah, when I went to see the play, I had already started rehearsal and I had already found my guy and I knew who he was. So I was not searching for inspiration whatsoever. I was just more curious to see the production because I had heard it was great. Even though I'm not the lead of the show, it requires a lot of strength and power to push back against that doctor. And I think I've accomplished that. So I'm proud of that. I don't know. Talk about my performance. I think it's easier for people to talk about it than myself.
Well, Yannick, it's fantastic to see you back on stage. I'm sure a lot of people are hoping that you can be back on stage in Montreal soon. I'm sure there's a lot of casting people that would love to have you back walking their boards. So thank you so much for taking the time to speak with Upstage.
Thank you. Thank you.
That was actor Yannick Truesdale. I spoke with him as he was starring in the run of Docteur by Robert Icke at Théâtre du Cèpe. I'm Sarah Day. You're listening to Upstage on CKUT 90.3 FM and at CKUT.ca, coming to you from my home yet again this week with three conversations I loved from the second half of 2023. Still to come, if you're looking for a new audio drama to sink your teeth into, get ready for Feedback. Jake Epstein has a career that many actors could only dream of. He grew up in Toronto, making his stage debut in a Soul Pepper production when he was just 12 years old. He was then cast as Craig Manning on the hit high school reboot Degrassi: The Next Generation. He played the young musician Craig Manning, and for that, Jake won a Gemini Award. But he eventually left the show after a few seasons in order to attend National Theatre School here in Montreal. Eventually, Jake moved to New York, landing roles in American Idiot, the Spider-Man musical, and Beautiful, the Carole King musical. And he made it back to TV in Designated Survivor. But still, he was plagued with doubts and struggles that any artist might relate to, and he started to spin stories from his career and life into a solo show called Boy Falls from the Sky, which he performed at the Siegel Center this fall. This happened right after the closing of Beautiful, the Carole King musical, which is a pretty harmonious segue since Jake originated the role of Jerry Goffin in the Broadway production. Jake joined me from his home in Toronto last November to talk about following your dreams and handling disappointment. Jake, welcome to Upstage. Thanks so much for being here.
Hi, my pleasure.
So you're familiar with Montreal. You lived here for a time.
I did, yes. I went to the National Theatre School of Canada. And so I got to spend 3 years in Montreal. And also, actually, my sister went to McGill. So I, as a high school student, like road trips to visit my older sister, kind of party a little bit at McGill. Like Montreal has always been kind of the greatest city in my mind. And I had an amazing time going to school there.
So you're coming home in a way, because we can call you an honorary Montrealer. Yeah.
Yes. Yes. And I actually, right after graduating, I did a show at the Siegel Center. It was Dangerous Liaisons. It was too many years ago to even want to say right now. So it's my first time being back at the Siegel Center, but this time doing my own show. So it's, I'm really excited about that.
And how does all this feel to you? You're doing a one-man show. You've done so many different things in your career, but to get to do a one-man show with a backing band, and now you're coming back to a city where you have some history. What's that like?
It's insane. I'm so lucky. I don't even have the right words to describe it. I'm incredibly grateful. I'm really excited just to get to be there in Montreal. I have a ton of family there, so I feel like half the audiences every night are just going to be like my cousins and aunts and uncles in the audience. So there'll be a lot of like morning beauties bagels, I'm sure, and like Schwartz's lunches in between shows. This show I wrote at a time in my life when I was really stuck and really confused about how to keep going. And so I wrote this show 4 years ago, and the fact that it's become this thing that I've gotten to perform around Canada and that it's meant something to people has just been way beyond my greatest dreams and, you know, expectations.
Did someone tell you, hey, Jake, you're going through some stuff, how about you start committing some of this to paper? Or was this self-motivated where you're like,
no,
it's time for me to write?
My wife was hosting a storytelling night in Toronto at this very cool theater. And I would go and watch her host, and people would go up on stage and tell stories from their lives. And I became obsessed with people telling true stories from their lives, because it was real. There's no faking it. So all of a sudden, stories were so funny because they were true, so moving because they were true. My wife like forced me to go up and tell a story one night, which I didn't really want to do, but it sort of forced me to tell a real story from my life. And I think that feeling kind of begun this, for lack of a better word, this journey of trying to write down some stories from my life. I sort of thought it would just be a bit of an exercise. I turned it into a little show, and I ended up pitching it to my favorite director in the country, Robert McQueen, who somehow agreed to work on it with me because I think he saw something there. And I think it's even though it's my story, I think it's a universal question that the show asks, which is, what do you do when life disappoints you, and how do you keep going? And in my case, it's about my childhood dream of trying to perform on Broadway, which is what this show's about.
Yeah, tell me what that's like, that experience. I think people, unlike so many other dreams that people have, I think people are very familiar with the idea of what it's like to try to be an artist and to maybe move to New York or another big city and to audition and like wait tables, for instance. What was that experience like for you?
Of going to New York? What was
give us a soupçon of like what that experience of like trying to make it big, because you achieved success early on in your career.
Yeah.
Prototypical journey that people might have in their heads, or is it something a bit different?
It was, yeah, for me, it was confusing because on paper, I was achieving this level of success. I was doing these Broadway tours. I eventually moved to New York. I was working on Broadway, and people would ask me all the time, how's it going? What's it like performing on Broadway? And I never had an honest answer, because behind the scenes, I was dealing with a whole host of things like debilitating stage fright and reviews and having to take steroids and injuries. And in the case of Beautiful, the Carole King musical, which I did on Broadway, I originated one of the lead roles. My character became the antagonist in the show. And I talk about this, and I was booed most nights at my curtain call. It was the, you know, it was the villain boo. Like, it was the boo that's reserved for, like, you know, the antagonist in the show. But here was my first time originating a role, and I was getting booed on Broadway. And I did it for a long time, and it started to really affect me. So I eventually moved home, and I had these, I mean, it was a confusing experience, because it was a really hard experience. And at the same time, it was my dream. And it was so not what I expected, and so in a way disappointing, which is, you know, what I'd mentioned earlier. What do you do? How do you keep going when you've achieved your childhood dream and it disappoints you? Where do you go from there? So that was kind of the question I had when I started writing down these stories.
Jake Epstein joins us here on Upstage talking about his upcoming show, Boy Falls from the Sky, coming to the Siegel Center. You talked about playing the role of Jerry in Beautiful and getting to be on stage. I was just curious to know if you had a chance to see Beautiful at the Siegel.
No, I didn't, because I've been performing my show in Ontario and other cities. But Tess Benger, who plays Carole King, is a friend, and I hear the production is fantastic, and sort of warmed my heart when I heard that the production that I'm following is Beautiful, the Carole King musical. It's kind of cool, actually.
I love when there's a continuity like that, and I think Siegel audiences are going to pick up on that, which is really fun. So you talk about having to process these dreams and kind of sit down and think about, all right, so have I made it? What's next? And you're writing down these stories, I guess, a little bit at the instigation of your wife. Taking the writing process after being a performer for so long, training at NTS, what was writing like for you? Was it difficult?
Well, at NTS, the thing that I fell in love with at the school was writing. I was there. It's a pretty intense institution. There's very small classes. Sometimes students get kicked out. There's sort of high pressure, high standards. Everyone's fighting for roles. And I wasn't getting the roles I wanted. I felt like I wasn't sort of finding my place there. And I had an amazing writing teacher named Kent Stinson, who encouraged me to start writing my own roles and my own scenes. And that became, so I wrote a one-person show when I was at NTS, and I wrote a series of other things there that became the highlights for me. I've probably learned more from doing that experience. And since then, I've been lucky enough to continue writing. So it wasn't my first time writing something down, but certainly the most public forum for my writing has been this show.
Now, Montreal audiences are not seeing the show at its first stages, because you've gotten a chance to perform it already in a couple of different places. I guess you'd basically say you're on tour right now. How do you feel like it's developed over time, having presented it, I guess, for the last, has it been like a year and a half that you've been performing the show?
Well, we first did it at the Toronto Fringe Festival 4 years ago.
Okay.
This is in the pre times. So the Cove kind of extended the life of the show, because it was postponed so many times. And Mervish, which is one of the, probably the main producer in Toronto, picked up the show from the Toronto Fringe and put it in the Royal Alex Theatre, which is a legendary theater in the city. And before that run, I'd been doing it and kept tweaking it and rewriting parts and moving around parts. I really wanted to take my time to make sure that if I was going to tell this personal story, I wanted to feel really good about it. And I had a bit of a pause. I had a child, and this is my first time working professionally since my son Miles was born. So this iteration, it's been a few months of doing the run. And one of the cool things about getting to revisit the show is getting to kind of look at, you know, the parts in the show that like never totally satisfied me getting to rewrite certain things and kind of taking the show back to its roots, which was at the Fringe Festival. It was really like an intimate show. So getting to kind of bring the show into a more intimate way, a smaller experience. It's kind of a stand-up show, and the whole thing is it's like a real conversation with an audience. So that's the thing that's been really magical about getting to revisit it is that intimacy with the show.
Well, congratulations firstly on the arrival of your son Miles. That's so wonderful. You have a really cute photo of him up on Instagram. I was looking through some of the comments that fans are leaving. People seem to really connect with the show. What do you feel like the feedback's been like from audience members, from other people that you worked with before, professionals who come to see the show?
Yeah, one of the gifts of doing the show is hearing feedback and people have expressed to me that my story is their story, that success isn't linear. And I had someone come up to me the other night who was she said she was a doctor, and she said that this is her story, which I thought was like the coolest feedback, because I'm like, do explain what you mean.
Yeah, I have questions.
But she was saying, you know, she on paper has this successful career, and she has really struggled and never been able to fully talk about the reality of life and to be able to laugh at the absurdity of her profession. And so she really connected to my story about doing musical theater on Broadway. So I think that's been the thing that's been really satisfying. And I just think it's really relieving to laugh at the absurdity of life. Everything is insane. The world is on fire. So to get to have a night out and, you know, be entertained and be moved and get to reflect on your life, it feels really important. It feels like a gift to get to invoke those kinds of feelings in people right now.
We're hearing from Jake Epstein, who's presenting his show at the Siegel Center. So in a sense, you just said, I've achieved my dream. I made it to Broadway. Then you're processing your career and the disappointments that you've had, but also measuring the successes. Now you're performing the show and honing it and performing it for audiences who are having a ball. And I'm just curious, this is probably hard to pivot to think of what the next thing is, but creatively, like, where do you go from here? Having to, you know, look at dreams, analyze them, like, what would be next for you as a writer or as a performer?
It's a great question. I mean, one of the cool things we got to do on this tour was film the show. So I have a dream of getting to show it to people on maybe a streamer or something like that. So that's something that's in the process right now. And then there's the next show. Like, then what's next, right? I love writing. And to be honest, regardless of whether or not I write something else that has any kind of success or gets in front of anyone else's eyes, I've already continued writing. I already have a bunch of ideas and would love to keep writing and performing my own work. Would be a real gift.
In some ways, you've had a career so far that I think like would be any actor's dream. You got to be a star on a huge Canadian soap opera that, you know, has earned you a lot of fans. You've been in what an amazing Hanukkah Hallmark romance movie I've seen. And you were in the Umbrella Academy. You're on a hit Netflix show. Like, you've done so many cool things, and not even to mention Broadway. So I was curious to know how being in a not one man show, you're on stage with other people. How does that experience of, you know, going to the Fringe and getting to be at the Royal Alex compare to all these other experiences that you've had so far in your career? I know it's a big question, but I just kept thinking, looking at what you've done and then getting to do this.
So firstly, thank you. I'm incredibly lucky, and I'm really, despite the fact that I'm telling a story about my disappointments in life, I'm fully aware of how fortunate I've been and how lucky I am to make a living doing the thing I love. I mean, it, you know, As soon as I studied at NTS in Montreal, I mean, that was a really humbling experience because I'd been doing Degrassi for 6 years. Degrassi, especially at the time, was a hit show. It was really popular. There were awards. We did tours in the US. We were filming. I was playing one of the main characters, and I left the show to go study theater, which people thought was absolutely bonkers. Why on earth would I do that? And part of me wanted to do it because I love acting so much and I wanted to study. And I come from an academic family, and it's, you know, if you want to do the thing you do, you go to school. I wanted to have that experience of going to school. So that immediately was very humbling, because I knew pretty early on that I wasn't really interested in the fame game or that side of things. Of course, it's an amazing thing if you get to experience it. Of course, there's weird downsides to all that. But to me, it's always been about the work. Even on Degrassi, the things that I enjoyed most about Degrassi was working with some great directors and getting to I loved my character. I had such a challenging character, and he went through so many hard things. So getting to perform at the Fringe to me was about the work. I wanted to develop this show. And I mentioned before that I got to work with Robert McQueen, who is this, I think, legendary theater director. And he said to me, if we're going to do this, you need to get into a festival so that we can put it in front of people and see where that goes. And so we got into the Fringe, and it was super humbling. You know, my dressing room, in heavy quotations, was a boiler room, you know, behind the thing. We did a bar. There's like, you know, noise and drinks and competing with all that. And it was just the most fun, satisfying thing ever. And to be honest, I think that's part of why the thing has been, I hate saying the word successful, but the reason that this show, I think, has been successful is because I didn't try to make it anything other than it was. I did it at the Fringe Festival. I was, I, you know, humbled myself to the whole experience of it. And so, yeah, so I just think I haven't really thought of it as like, I'm lowering myself by performing at the Fringe or anything like that. To me, it was just, what a fantastic opportunity to get to do it in front of people that want to see it.
Yeah. You're producing the show just like any other Canadian artist would, you know, present their yeah. one person.
Well, it's hard to develop a thing.
Yeah.
You know, it's really tough. And I almost think the show is like a stand-up show. Like you talk to any stand-up comedian, how do you learn what's working or not? You put it in front of people. You play a tiny room with 5 people. You play a room with 1,000 people. You see where the laughs are. You learn what the show is. And so yeah, I did it at the Fringe. I did it, you know, in Bob Cajun. I did it during COVID online. I did it Port Hope, Port Dover, you know, every port you can imagine. I just kind of kept going wherever I could find audiences. And that really taught me, my timing taught me what was working and what wasn't working.
So many great stories that you're going to be telling on stage at Port Montreal at the Siegel Center.
Port Montreal.
I can imagine that one thing that people most probably want to know about is how you deal with stage fright. So that's my last question for you. People hearing that actors have stage fright, it just sounds like it doesn't make sense for audience members.
Right.
So how do you get around that?
I learned early on. Yeah. I get nervous before every single show. I get nervous before I film anything. I wish I didn't. My sister is an amazing performer named Gabby Epstein, who is a McGill graduate actually. And I talked to her about it, and she never gets nervous, which just totally blows my mind. So some people don't, but for me, I got great advice early on, which was to bring your fear with you on stage, as opposed to thinking, I shouldn't be nervous. I should be this. Start from exactly where you are, which is nervous, because something might happen when you just start, which is you might have fun, or you might get comfortable, or it might shift into something else. or you might stay nervous and people might just feel really bad for you because they can tell you're kind of nervous and give you some like sympathy laughs and applause. So I think about that all the time. I bring my nervousness sits on my shoulder with me for every show, and it means people who are nervous, I think it means they care. They care about the story. They want to do a good job telling the story. That's what's behind the nervousness, is wanting to tell the story well.
Is baby Miles coming with you to Montreal to meet the rest of your family here, or is he going to stay put?
He'll be there for a part of it.
Okay. My wife
is going to sneak him into a dress rehearsal. So I think he's going to try to watch me maybe a little bit.
Otherwise, it would be so hard to leave him for such a long period of time, eh?
Oh my God, tell me about it. I am freaking out a little bit about it. But no, we have a lot of help, and my wife and mom, very fortunate. They're going to come for a few parts of it. So that'll be great.
I'm sure he's going to be your harshest critic.
Oh, yeah. He will. Yeah, if he's not interested, he'll cry, he'll turn away. Totally.
Jake, thanks so much for coming on Upstage. Have a blast in Montreal.
My pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.
That was actor and writer Jake Epstein. He was in Montreal to perform his solo musical, Boy Falls from the Sky, at the Siegel Center. Keep up with him at jakeepstein.ca and on Instagram at @officialjakeepstein. I'm Sarah Day, and you're listening to Upstage on CKUT 90.3 FM and at CKUT.ca. Coming to you from my home this week, three conversations I loved from the second half of 2023. Kevin Shea used to work in customer service, and he knew that the odd and sometimes dramatic calls he took would one day make good fodder for a drama. So he cast and collaborated with a friend and actor, Qasim Khan, as a phone company customer service agent who builds a friendship with someone unlikely. He, Akbar, is a gay person of color, part-time drag queen, and she, Valerie, is a white senior citizen who is losing her son to online extremism. Here is a preview of Feedback, where Akbar is trying to help Valerie remember a password.
Who is baseball?
Baseball isn't a question. Is there a question?
That's the clue you gave us when you set up your account, the word baseball.
Is there anything else there?
No, ma'am. Do you follow baseball, or?
No, I don't. Martin likes the Jays. Is Blue Jays the answer?
Let's see. No.
It's the name of a team, though?
I can't say.
Can you think of what it is? The security answer?
No, let me see it. I have it written here. The Wi-Fi password is IBK3.
Sorry, ma'am, it's not the password for your Wi-Fi. It's for your Ring wireless account.
Marty, it's not the Wi-Fi password.
It's your phone account security answer.
It's the phone account security answer.
Take the Wi-Fi password.
I can't take the Wi-Fi password. I just need the security answer for your Ring wireless account.
It just needs the security answer.
I don't know what that is.
All right. Look, what's your name?
Akbar.
Akram?
Yes.
A short excerpt from Feedback with Akbar and Valerie getting to know each other. The writer, Kevin, turned to Jill Harper as director. Longtime collaborators and friends, their company Q6 is an award-winning group based in Toronto that wants to, quote, help audiences safely investigate and challenge their own beliefs. The 9-part series is titled Feedback. It launched last month. You can get it wherever you find your podcasts. I spoke with Jill and Kevin last fall. Thank you both so much for being here.
Thank you for having us.
Kevin, I wanted to start with you. This is rooted in your work experience. Tell me about this job that you ended up doing in your 20s.
Well, when I was still in university, I was casting about for a job related to the arts, and I found this position at a theater here in Toronto where I live, and they had an opening for a box office representative, which was part-time and fit around my school schedule and seemed like it would be a fun place to work. So I applied for the job and got it and ended up working there for a few years, which was generally fun, sometimes a bit stressful because like any sort of job related to customer service, there can sometimes be challenging people. So I ended up working there and meeting a bunch of other artists, including a guy named Qasim, who sort of later on went on to become a big actor in Canada. He's performed all across the country, and we stayed friends, and I ended up having this idea for a thing that I could write for him that would be sort of loosely inspired by our time answering phones in a box office, even though in the show itself, he's answering phones for a telecom company.
Why did you choose to move it to a telecom company from a theater box office?
I wanted it to be the most banal kind of customer service situation, and one that would be very relatable to anyone. Not everyone goes to the theater, but almost everyone has argued with their mobile phone provider or internet provider at some point in their lives. And also the sort of idea of them discussing a sort of billing issue at a communications company. The show is somewhat about communication. So it sort of thematically was linked to what I was trying to talk about.
I work in radio where I pick up the phones, and I know that you can hear just about anything on the other end of the line. It could be like a super positive, bubbly person giving you a traffic tip, or someone who's like angry at everything and just needed to tell someone that. So I could just imagine that doing the kind of work, you know, being on the other end of the phone line that you were doing, tons of potential stories kind of came up. So were you actively, you know, like as someone who's developing their artistic career, but also getting paid, doing a job, were you thinking of things and thinking this would make a great story? Or like, was there more like a moment afterwards where you looked back on it and said like, there's potential here?
Definitely while we were doing the job between calls, we would talk about some of the wild things we would hear or the sort of characters that we would encounter. I wasn't consciously thinking, oh, this is going to be great material necessarily, but obviously as a writer, kind of everything ends up being potential material. But they were very memorable experiences sometimes because the intensity of someone would just be, it would just be so memorable. It would just be, you know, someone would be so angry or would be in a situation that was so extraordinary or surprising, or the intimacy of it would be so, you know, would catch you off guard in such a way that they became very memorable experiences. So I definitely didn't have the idea to do something in that milieu until much, much later. But when I did have the idea, I had such a wealth of sort of emotional experience and memories to draw on.
And Jill, as the editor and the director, producer, eventually, when you started hearing, I'm curious about the process between you and Kevin, when you started hearing about this idea, like take shape, what came to you in terms of like potential for drama, potential for storytelling? What stood out to you?
Yeah, I mean, Kevin and I have worked together before. We had done the last piece of live theater that I did before the pandemic was a play that Kevin wrote called Consumption Patterns. And so we kind of, you know, we had a working relationship, which was great. And then the world shut down a bit and Kevin came to me and said, hey, I have an idea for something and I think we could record it. Like, I think we could do it even though we can't do live theater. And this is what it is. And I think, you know, the things that stood out to me really were how much this story lends itself to this specific medium. I think a lot of people do, you know, podcasts, fiction podcasts about any number of things, but because it was such a communication-based, phone-based, and then context that, like, you know, it was very easy to make into an audio show, but then we started expanding out what other versions of audio you could play with as well. So hearing advertisements for things, hearing the radio or the television in the background, what are the other ways, you know, a conversation through an intercom at a condo, like what are other ways that we can keep expanding this format? But then, as you're saying, like the actual drama of the piece and these characters were just so clearly something, a world that I wanted to live in. I thought they were so much fun and there was so much opportunity there.
I want to get to that now. That is the voice of Jill Harper, who is the director and editor of Feedback, as well as one of the producers. The creator is Kevin Shea. So, Kevin, the character being based on this friend of yours, Kasum, who plays the character, he's got a lot going on in his world, but we mostly get to meet him in the sense of this relationship he has with a caller who is very different from him. So tell me about that relationship and how it moves the story forward.
Well, so Kasum plays a character named Akbar, who is mostly focused on his career as a drag queen, but is doing this call center job to make ends meet, and is someone who doesn't care that much about the job, but does care about doing a good job. So he's very, very committed to trying to help people, to trying to understand where people are coming from, and find ways to make them feel better. And he ends up getting a call from this very distressed woman who's, like you said, very different from him. He lives downtown. She lives in the suburbs. He's, you know, in his 30s. She's in her 60s. He's gay. And, you know, his parents are from Pakistan. And she's white and heterosexual. And she leans conservative and he leans left. So it ends up being this sort of exchange between two very different bubbles. And it's the kind of exchange that it's very hard to have. It's very rare that these exchanges happen in our lives, except in situations where you might be in on a dealing in a customer service type relationship. So this woman doesn't know anyone like Akbar, but she gets to talking with him because she's got this issue with her phone bill. And over the course of trying to resolve this issue, they end up developing this intimacy and they end up getting to know each other. And of course, it's a little bit one-sided because he's there because it's his job and he has to be there and he's being paid to do it. But I think over the course of the story, you sort of see how they are able to expand their sort of understanding and empathy towards these people that are very different to them. And yeah, that was sort of the story that I was interested in telling, the limits of that, but also the sort of possibilities of it.
Jill was hinting at some of the possibilities that you were looking to enriching the story. Something in specific you said was bringing in the sound of hearing like the TV in the background, in addition to the fact that, you know, most of the action is happening in phone calls. What kind of challenges for the both of you did you find in going from a live theater piece where you're setting things up on a stage to writing for the ear and directing and editing for the ear? Jill, maybe you can tell me about how that process proved to be a challenge.
Yeah, I mean, so many ways, from just the organizational side of things where, you know, we're very used to how to run a theater rehearsal and a schedule that gets us through to opening night. Whereas with this, you know, even just breaking a script down differently, because you don't need those people who are on the television. They don't need to be there on the same day or in the same hour as the people who are, you know, having the conversation on the phone. And so making decisions about how to actually record this, I think, was a big one for us. And then, you know, including elements like our soundtrack, which is by a composer named Brian Geelan, who's incredible. And I think it really elevates the show. But, you know, getting to play with some of those elements was great. But I think the other thing for Kevin and I, because we do come from such a visual storytelling place, we also put a lot of thought into what we should and shouldn't do telling a story through audio. And Kevin's included this incredible device of each of these characters having a narrator that gives us a lot of background into their lives. And so we get to learn a lot more about them. But we didn't want to do that. I think what the narrators allow us to do is find out all that information in a way that doesn't feel inauthentic. Sometimes in an audio format, you know, if you want to tell someone something that you would normally show them, all of a sudden you have characters saying things that they would never actually say. Oh, look who's coming through that door right now. You know, whatever those things might be. And we really wanted to get away from any of that. We wanted it to feel natural and honest. And so playing with what we could do with these narrators really allowed us to get away from having to do so much of that stuff and really let it stay in this sort of audio place and to stay really honest and interesting.
Kevin, does that ring true to you as the writer, kind of like how you had to change a little bit how you structure things and imagine things for the listener?
Yes, it was a wonderful opportunity. I love fiction. I love literature. And to be able to mix something more literary with something still very dramatic and still using these incredible performers to animate these characters, it was really exciting. So from the beginning, we knew that, or I knew that there was going to be these narrator characters who would provide this really rich background. And then we would sort of go back and forth between those narrators and these conversations. And I think it worked out really well. I'm very happy with how it all sounds connected and how organic it ends up feeling.
So feedback is out in the world. It's been just over a month. What's the reaction been like? And are you guys motivated to make another one like this? Jill?
The reaction has been fantastic. The number of people who have, you know, called me up and called all of us up and said how much they loved this thing. We made it to number 5 on Apple Podcasts fiction charts in our first week, which was very exciting. And I think one of the things that I love about this format, as opposed to theater, with theater, you have sort of a 3-week time period where you've got to get people to go or else it's gone. And this one, we can keep telling people that it's out there and people can keep finding their way to it, which I really love. But yeah, people seem to be really loving it, which is great.
Kevin, do you think you have another audio story in you?
That's a great question. I'm not interested in taking just any story and seeing if there's a way to make it into audio. I would want to have, it would have to be something that is great for your ears first, above anything else. So right now I don't have any, anything written, but I do have some ideas, but I'm going to let those percolate a little bit longer.
Keyword percolate. Last question very quickly for you both. Has there anyone who, you know, a loved one who lives somewhere far away, not easy for them to get to the theater perhaps, that has been able to listen to it and has told you, wow, I got to see some of your work, I got to hear some of your work and I didn't have to come to Toronto for it?
Who I've heard back from. I know that it's been wonderful to be able to share it with, you know, I have an uncle in Japan and to be able to share it with him, but I just haven't talked to him about it yet.
I will say one thing that happened that really surprised me was a good friend of mine from university who I haven't heard, like we haven't spoken in 10, 15 years, sent me a message and was like, I just listened to feedback and I love it. And that made me feel so great. And I think, and that can happen with the theater in theory, but I think there's something about this, the fact that he could listen to it from his home with his kids, you know, that you don't have to come out maybe when you don't have time in your life in that same way. And it really warmed my heart to get that message.
Well, here's hoping that that uncle in Japan has a good listen before you guys have your holiday Zoom call. And likewise for you, Jill. It was so nice to meet both of you. Congratulations on feedback. What an achievement. Thank you for coming on Offstage.
Thank you, Sarah. Thank you so much.
That was Jill Harper and Kevin Shea. They are both executive producers behind Feedback, a new audio drama available wherever you get your podcasts. Jill directed the series and also served as editor, and Kevin wrote the script. Their company is online at Q6. That's CUE6.ca. You can visit them on Instagram and Facebook. You've been listening to Upstage on CKUT 90.3 FM and at CKUT.ca, our very first episode of 2024, for which we revisited some of my favorite conversations from the second half of last year. Tonight, you heard actor Yannick Truesdale, actor Jake Epstein, and of course, Jill Harper and Kevin Shea behind Feedback. A big thank you to my guests. You can listen to past episodes of Upstage at CKUT.ca under the archives. And follow us for updates, images of guests, and more on Instagram at UpstageCKUT. Thank you to Jack Seller, our spoken word coordinator, for making sure the show gets to air. And thank you for tuning in. I'm your host, Sarah Day. Speak with you next time on Upstage on CKUT 90.3 FM and CKUT.ca. Have fun. Stay safe. Up next is Grey Matters with my friend Fortner Anderson.
WCKUT, Henry Grimes. And stay tuned for more of the most aesthetic things, feelings in the world.
Mary Shad Carey. Born a free black in Wilmington, Delaware, in 1823, within a family active in the Underground Railroad, Mary Shad Carey was an educator, a writer and editor, an abolitionist, a women's rights advocate, and a suffragist. She founded several schools for both black and white students, the first when she was only 16, and served as a teacher and principal in many others. In 1851, she moved to Canada and established herself in Windsor, where she lived most of the second half of her life.
Good evening and welcome to the January 4th edition of Grey Matter. Tonight we'll be presenting a lecture by Russell Means entitled Knowing Who You Are, Lessons from Native America. It was recorded in Boulder, Colorado